faith-filled finance. All major UK bank accounts. One app. Provision is built by Christians to help you steward what God's given you. Track your spending, saving and giving in one place. Join the waitlist now at provision.money and get your first month free. That's provision.money.
Premier Podcast.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile. I'm Emily Howarth, Deputy Editor of Premier Youth and Children's Work. Today I'm joined by Tim Alford, former lead singer of Christian band Dweeb, now head of Limitless, the youth wing of the Elim Churches in the UK. Hello, Tim.
Hey, good to be here.
Shall we start at the beginning of your life?
Okay, that's a good place to start.
How did you become a Christian?
My folks are Christians, so they took me along to church from year dot, really, and so I became a Christian when I was quite young. I was 7 years old, and you know, from that point, I never really looked back, actually. So for a number of my friends who became Christians when they were young, they had that story of, you know, they went off to uni, they turned away from God, maybe in their 20s they came back, maybe they didn't. But that never really happened to me. Of course, I made plenty of mistakes and, you know, did things that I shouldn't have done and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But I never lost my faith and I never stopped pursuing God. And when I look back and I ask myself, well, why was that? I have so much to thank both my parents and the local church I was brought up in my hometown of Exeter for, because for them, God wasn't just someone to be talked about. He was somebody to know. The power of God wasn't something that happened in the scripture. It was something that happened now. And so it was part of the fabric of life and the fabric of our church life that you would hear from God and that you would prophesy. It was part of the fabric of our church life that you would pray for people to be filled with the Spirit, and they would be filled with the Spirit. And I think that's the reason that I didn't have that period of turning away from God, because there was a foundation which was rooted, as the Apostle Paul said, not in man's wisdom but in God's power. He said, my message and preaching are not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith would not rest in man's wisdom but on the Spirit's power. And I feel like that's what it was, and that was a strong foundation for me. So I had a fairly steady discipleship from that young age, I think.
And what was your earliest memory of church?
My earliest memory of church, I remember the church never had a building, so it used to meet in schools. And I think probably my earliest memory of the church is just literally running around in the playgrounds of the schools, you know, after the services with all the other kids that were the part of the church. It was a big family church, lots of little kids, and I was obviously a little kid at the church. So I think I've got traces in my mind where I can picture the playgrounds and the running around and you know, the playing football and all of that stuff.
And what was it like being a teenager in your church?
It was good, actually. Yeah, we had some great youth workers. They weren't afraid to talk to us about the big issues. They were available to us. It's funny because now, obviously, being in youth work and understanding that as a ministry, I didn't think of them as youth workers. That wasn't like a concept that I grasped really at the time. I just thought of them as friends and mentors, really. And so we were quite close and, yeah, shared things together. And it was at such a time where there was, I guess, quite a lot of fire and passion in amongst my friends who were in the youth group. So, you know, we really pursued God together, and we wanted to see God use us, and we were seeing people become Christians and all of that kind of stuff. So it was a good experience of being in a youth group. Yeah.
And if you could tell your teenage self one thing, what would it be?
Yeah, you know, I think as I've gone through my life, maybe the lesson that I've personally owned the most is is that the greatest things in life are always the ones that cost you the most. And that's how it is with choosing to follow Jesus, isn't it? It's the most costly choice, but it's definitely the best one. But I think that's true of so many things. As I look back over the course of my life, the greatest adventures that I've had, the most memorable experiences in my life, the things that I'll look back on and I'll never forget, they've been the ones that also cost me the most. I don't mean financially. I might mean in terms of energy, in terms of effort, in terms of sacrifice, in terms of being uncomfortable. They're the ones that cost the most. They take the most out of you, but they also pour the most back into you. So I think I'd say, Tim, the greatest things in life, they're going to be the ones that cost you the most. So don't shy away from the cost.
We're going to definitely come on to more about youth work once we start talking about Limitless. But should we talk about music?
Okay, let's do that.
So when did you start getting interested in music?
Well, I started playing the drums when I was 10. I don't know, my parents just got me drum lessons, I guess. And I loved it. And it kind of went from there, really, you know. So I did all of my grades. And, you know, when I was in school, did a little kind of school band. And, you know, we wrote some songs and kind of took it from there. And when I finished school, I did a National Diploma in Popular Music at college, and I absolutely loved that. And thereafter went to Nexus, and then from there was in a band for a number of years after that as well. So I guess it probably started when I was 10 playing the drums.
And at what point did your interest in music cross over with your faith?
I think always, really. Again, probably I've got a lot to thank my church and my parents and my youth group for. In that faith and God was always... I didn't know anything else other than that being central to my life. It was never an add-on. It was never a God is for Sundays and, you know, music and school and whatever else. That's something else. That's something separate. I guess I was always taught and raised that God would permeate everything. And so... it was very naturally the expression of my passion for music and for drumming in particular that would be part of my faith. And of course, you know, being a young Christian musician, inevitably you end up on the worship team, don't you? So I was and again grateful to my church, and maybe this is one of the reasons I stayed in church as well, that they asked me to play drums from a very, very young age. And I'm not too convinced that my drumming was particularly helpful for the others in the congregation at that time, but it was certainly helpful for me in the kind of longevity of staying in church and wanting to be there and being part of that worship team was really key for me.
And you went on to study at the Christian Music College Nexus. What was that like?
It was wonderful. It was a really formative year in my life, and I'd speak really highly of it. Again, we just had a very passionate year group. We would be up early in the prayer room. We would be holding our own prayer meetings that weren't organized by Nexus, but just because we wanted to go deeper into God just in our houses. A great time, and really a formative time, and I learned a lot about myself and who God had made me to be. And so the culture was, forgive me for the cliche, but I'd say the culture at that time in the year group I was in was very much iron sharpening iron, in that we were challenging each other, but by making the most out of the year, by getting up early to go to the prayer room, by doing our hours of practice that we were and some more that we were asked to do each day, by doing all of our Bible reading notes, by doing the best on our papers. As you saw others doing that, it would inspire you to do that. As you did that, it would inspire others to do that. And so I think we set quite a high mark for each other at that time. And so I think we really squeezed the juice out of the year. I think, you know, Nexus is the same as Regents, where I work, is the same as everything else. And it is 100% true to say that you get out of it what you put into it. And I think as a year group, we put a lot into it. And so we got a lot out of it. It was a great year.
Why do you think a Christian music college that's specifically Christian is so important?
Because I think that... I think there's a couple of angles on that, really. I think that we need more and more Christian musicians, yes, but artists, actors, performers, business people, teachers, to know how to do ministry in the public sphere, but particularly in those places of influence, be that politics, be that music, be that media, where we won't just have our own kind of subculture that only Christians participate in, but actually we'll have a voice, a prophetic voice, and music is a way to do that. And so I think it's really important to train musicians to have a prophetic voice in the public sphere, but also to train us how to worship through song and how to lead others to worship through song as well. Obviously remains a key tenet of the church, and so to continue to train people to do that is important.
And there you met Dweeb. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, before I went, I decided that I was going to start a band. As I mentioned, like, drums was my first instrument, and when I went to college and did a National Diploma in Popular Music, I did a couple of things. One was that I got free guitar lessons, so I started learning to play guitar. And the other was that we had this little jazz residency in the pub next door. So every Thursday lunchtime, with pretty much nobody in the pub, we would go in and we'd do a little jazz gig with the college students. As well as drumming, I'd sing a few standards or whatever. But going to Nexus, I was doing the drum course. I was doing the drum program. And I thought, I want to keep going with the singing and the guitar. I want to just keep practicing that and getting better at that. So I thought, just for a bit of fun, I've never done it before, I'm going to start a band where I sing and play guitar. And I'd already decided to do that before I went. So basically, I let a few weeks go by, watched a few of the live playing workshops where all the musicians went through, found out who all of the best people were, and asked those people to be in my band. So basically, I wasn't very good at guitar and singing, but all the people in the band were incredible. So they made me look better than I was. And so that's how we started. But it was only ever supposed to be just a little bit of fun, put into practice what we were learning at Nexus, maybe play a few gigs in some of the pubs in Coventry or the rock clubs or whatever. It was only ever supposed to be for a year. That's all it was supposed to be. I had a place at university afterwards doing music. A couple of the other guys had plans as well. But God had different plans, I guess.
And you got signed, though.
After a time, so I guess the story was that during the course of the year, God began to speak to us about, actually, you need to lay down your places at university because I'm asking you to do this as a ministry now, which at the time was hugely, hugely scary. And so it took us a while, but we got there in the end, and eventually we were obedient and said yes. And so we just gigged as hard as we could, and we released a couple of EPs just off our own back. Then for our first album, we signed with a small independent label called Risen Records, and those guys were so, so good to us. There was a real community around that label, and they really invested in us, and we were really grateful to them. And then for our second release, Feels Like Dynamite, we signed with Fierce, who were part of Kingsway, and that record came out under them. Yeah.
And what was life like recording an album?
Not as glamorous as it sounds. So we toured a lot. We gigged really, really, really hard all over Europe. Which at first was just wild, but then obviously as we got older and started getting into relationships, and some guys in the band started to get married, and eventually before we finished we were all married, that started to become tougher. Being away from home, being away from family, trying to balance all of that stuff was challenging for sure, but we loved it. Don't get me wrong, we loved playing in different places and meeting different people and seeing different countries, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience, but not without challenge. And the songwriting thing, well, we argued a lot in the practice room, but because we really, really cared about it, and actually it did enable us to really get the best out of our songs, I think. But it was sometimes quite a painful process writing the songs. Recording was always good fun as well, but again, there would have been tensions about how we wanted the mix to be or what we wanted in terms of the production and all of that kind of stuff. But which we cared about it, you know, we were passionate about it, and so it was a painful process at times, but also a really fun process at the same time. Greatest things in life are always the ones that cost you the most.
What would that process look like? Where did song go from just lines on a page to being?
Yeah, okay. So the way we used to do it was all of us would write. We would come to a rehearsal with the seeds of an idea. So we might have a riff, or we might have a chorus, or we might just have a groove, some lyrics, or anywhere from the seeds of an idea, and sometimes that like a full song that had just been written on an acoustic with the vocal. And then we would take those ideas and then we would craft them together. So we'd arrange them together, we'd change the melodies, we'd take sections out, we'd add sections in, and as a band, as a group, we would form that into the into the finished song. We'd gig that a bit, sometimes we'd make changes to the track having gigged it, and then we'd take it to the studio.
And which did you prefer, studio time or gigging?
Oh, gigging. Yeah, 100%. 100%. Because the reason we were doing it, as much as we love music and music was important to us and it was an expression or an overflow of the heart, the reason we were doing it was to share Jesus. And there was nothing like, getting into a room full of people playing songs and sharing Jesus. And we would do that wherever we went. What we tried to do is we didn't have like a set agenda of we're going to say this. We always had a space within the set where we knew we'd say something. And sometimes that would be as little as, well, this song is about, and we'd explain something of our faith. Or it would be as much as a full mini gospel talk and an appeal. And we would often do appeals and see people come to faith in that way and anywhere in between that. But what we would do is before every show, we would ask God, what do you want to say to these people? And so it would look different from gig to gig.
Touring must have been incredibly intense.
Yeah.
How did you manage life on the road?
We were best friends. But it's probably more accurate to say brothers. Not blood brothers, but our relationship was like brothers. So we loved each other intensely. But we wound each other up big time as well. Just lots of time in the road, in the van, driving around. And how did we manage it? I don't know. I think we just went from show to show and thought, wow, what a privilege it is to be doing this. Literally, we're living a dream. It had been a dream, for all of us, it had been a dream to do stuff like that. And we were living it. So even in the times where it did get intense and it did get difficult and we butted heads and didn't see things the same way, still we knew that it was a gift to be doing what we were doing, and we were grateful to God for it and tried to honour him with it.
And your favourite venue of all the gigs you played, is there one?
Oh, that's tricky. We had a little bit of a love affair with Slovakia, weirdly. We went out there loads and loads of times. We did two-week tours in Slovakia. There was a festival out there called Campfest, which was a big festival that we loved playing. We felt we had a great rapport with the people there. And there was another one in Sweden called Frizon Festival, which we really loved that one as well. So it'd probably be between those two, yeah.
And you were on a reality TV show.
Yeah.
Called Singing with the Enemy. Would you like to explain the concept of that show?
So the concept was that it was a series, and each episode would feature two bands. And the idea being that these two bands would be very, very different from one another because of their genre or because of their belief system, or the thing that drove them or motivated them as a band. The idea was to live with them in the house, to write and record and finally perform a song together. And obviously this would all be filmed by the BBC and put out on national television. So yes, we were approached on the basis that we were Christians, that we were a rock band, but we were doing it because we wanted to share our faith. The band that we were in the house with were called Paparazzi Whore. and they described themselves as sleazy punk rock. That was their description. And the twist in the tale was that Mickey, who was the lead singer, was married to Chris, who was the bass player, but also at the same time in a relationship with Susie, who was the vocalist, another vocalist in the band. And obviously the intent of the producers was that they'd put us in a house together and sparks would fly and everybody would hate each other and it would make great TV. But that isn't how it turned out. So what eventually ended up happening was that we got on with them really well. We wrote a half-decent song, I guess, together. It was all right. We found a kind of middle ground. But the real incredible thing that happened was that when they came to our gig, we went to one of their gigs where there were strippers. So that was awkward. So we left so that we couldn't see it. And that caused an argument between their band, not between them and us. And then they came to our gig, and I read a little bit from Romans 8. And Susie, the backing vocalist, had a real encounter with the Holy Spirit. She was into New Age spirituality, so she described it in using some of that language in a way that she could understand. But her words were, "It felt like I was falling in love for the first time." And she ended up leaving the band, their band, Paparazzi Whore, during the show, and asking if I want to find out more about this Christianity stuff. How do I do that? She said to them when we went there, "You know what? I actually feel like I'm more like the guys in Dweeb than I am like you guys." Their kind of relationship broke off, and she left the band. She left the TV show during it all happening. So it was amazing. And of all the things we did, that was probably the thing that had the greatest impact. We had people write to us afterwards who'd become Christians because they watched the show. We had people who had encounters with the Holy Spirit in their living rooms watching the show. We had people who were Christians just saying, "Thank you for finally a positive representation of Christianity in the media." We had people, we even had people who were gay write to us and say, "Thank you for the way that you dealt with that." It was amazing. And we had our fair share of abuse as well, as you might well imagine, but comparatively very, very small. And we put ourselves into a really kind of risky position, but we believe that God had asked us to do that. We had loads and loads and loads of people praying for us, and God really, really used it. And you know, again, this is the greatest things in life are always the ones that cost you the most, because it was really hard going, being like constantly filmed for 9 days, just feeling the pressure of like, this is going to be on national TV, everybody who's a Christian is going to be watching this and judging, you know, if we're representing well or not. Judging's probably not the right word, but they will be concerned that we're representing well. And God was just exceeded our expectations. But the greater the risk, the greater the reward.
And did you get much say over the final edit of the show?
None at all. And so there was a moment. So I mentioned earlier that when we went to their gig, that there were strippers at the gig. And what happened in that moment is, for the start of their show, when they were playing, we were at the front, we were cheering them on, you know, we were supporting them, we were into the gig. Then the strippers came on, and it was like an L-shaped bar. So we left the front, we went round the corner, so we could hear the music, but we couldn't see the stage. And we were really concerned when that finished, because of course they could have cut from a stripper on stage to us at the front cheering. They could have cut that, and that would have been the end of what we were doing forever. Like, if that had gone out. And so obviously we were saying to the producers during that, you have to show this as it happened, and thankfully they did. And actually, whilst the timeline of how everything panned out on the final edit of the show wasn't exactly accurate, the narrative was, and so they did cut it quite faithfully, to be fair to them, I guess.
Eventually the band decided to break up. Was that an easy decision to make?
I wouldn't describe it as an easy decision, but it was a unified decision. So the way it happened is we were on tour, actually, in Slovakia. It was one of those 2 weeks tours in Slovakia. About a year before we finished, almost exactly. And I wasn't praying. I wasn't asking God about it. But just out of the blue, like clear as day, God said to me, I want you to put Dweeb on the altar like Abraham did with Isaac. I want you to do one more year. These are the things that I want you to do, and then I want you to finish. And I was like, wow, okay. It's just like a bolt. That's rarely happened to me in my life. Only on a couple of occasions have I heard from God like that, but it was as clear as day.
And where did...
This is how it happened. It's so unspiritual. You're going to be so disappointed.
The name Dweeb come from?
The pub. A load of us went to this pub down the road from Nexus called the Albany. And the barman gave me the wrong drink. And I thought, oh, I'll be all right. So I just went back and gave it to him. I said, oh, really sorry, mate. I think he misheard it. And he gave me this. And he said, what a dweeb. And I said, that's what we should call the band. But I think it reflected us quite well because we were quite zany and like we lighthearted and we love to have a bit of fun. So
Tim is back with us after the break with some more of his life's journey.
It was 50 years ago when young missionary Jackie Pullinger left London and got on a boat to Hong Kong, determined to share God's love with those in need. Miracles followed. Now she's challenging the church to get on with the job.
My message is always the same. It's how to get us sure enough of God's love so we can go out and share it with the lost.
Read the full interview with this inspiring evangelist exclusively in Premier Christianity magazine.
This is very short life, and eternal life is forever. We're going to feel all stupid if we wasted this one.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
You're listening to The Profile. I'm Emily Howarth from Premier Youth and Children's Work. We're continuing with Tim Alford, formerly of Dweeb, now head of Limitless, the youth wing of the Elim churches in the UK. So a big thing for Dweeb was being mainstream, but honest about your faith.
Yeah.
Was that a difficult balance to achieve?
It wasn't a difficult balance to achieve because it's who we were and because we knew that that is what God had called us to do. And often people said to us, because we played the Christian events and festivals in the UK and around Europe, but we also played rock clubs, venues, just mainstream venues. And so we kind of attacked it from both angles, if you like. And people often said to us, if you try and do both, you'll never get accepted in terms of the mainstream. You'll not get very far in terms of that thing. And we knew that that was true, and we knew that that was right and based evidence based. But we knew that that's what God asked us to do, so we just did it.
And that balance, is that something you see at the minute in the Christian music scene?
No. You don't see a lot of bands in the UK doing now what we were doing then. At that time, there was a load of them doing that kind of thing, who we were on the road with and would play at various events with. But now it seems that and to be fair, the caveat to this is I'm not as plugged into that scene as I was, so there may well be things going on that I don't know about, so I should say that. But how I see it now is you see either worship bands or you see kind of schools bands who do schools ministry, but what you don't see a lot of bands, I don't think, you might correct me, doing what we were doing in terms of being performance based bands, but doing ministry in the clubs and in the pubs and in the venues and that kind of stuff. I don't see a great deal of that now.
What do you make of characters like Bieber and Stormzy being so open about their faith?
Yeah, what do I think? On the one hand, I think it's great because they're influencers. And like we were saying earlier, we need influencers who are Christians and who are really following Jesus and who really love Jesus. But are doing it in the marketplace, in the mainstream, if you like, not just in a Christian subculture. So I think that's great. And you know, the whole thing of Bieber at Coachella leading worship, that whole thing went viral, didn't it? And I thought that was brilliant. I love that. And we know that he's, you know, he's good friends with some of these kind of American pastors like your Carl Lentz's and your Rich Wilkerson Jr.'s and all of these guys, and he goes along to the Hillsong conferences, doesn't he? And he's plugged into that scene. So I think that's wonderful. I think that's great. And it's great for youth workers to be able to share some of that stuff with our young people. Maybe they're believers. And Stormzy, you know, the whole Blinded by Your Grace thing and all of that, brilliant. I mean, it's fair to say that the album is not necessarily something that I'd want my children to listen to.
Yeah, the lyrics aren't exactly PG, are they?
Exactly, yeah. And my kids are 4 and 2, so that would not be appropriate. Yeah, so there's a bit of a thing in me which thinks that's a bit of a dichotomy to have a Blinded by Your Grace and then some of the other tracks on the album don't quite seem to dovetail to me. You know, but I'm not here to be critical, and I think that, you know, Blinded by Your Grace and you know, everyone is working out their faith journey, aren't they? Better that he's putting that in his tracks than he's hiding it, for sure.
And where did your life go post-dweeb?
We'd planned to finish a year ahead, so it gave us some time to process that and to ask God what he was calling us to do. And it's kind of a funny story in that I went to an open day at Regent's Theological College just to see about, is this something that I would think about doing? But just felt like God said no. I was almost a little bit disappointed. But the weird thing was that by the third year that I would have been on the course as a student, I was teaching it. And if you had told me that when I'd gone to that open day, I would have laughed. I would never have conceived of it. I never would have believed you. But God works in mysterious ways, doesn't he? So it ended up being that for a couple of years, I worked with an evangelist called Mark Greenwood, who's now Elam's national evangelist. At the time, he ran his a ministry, a charity called the 43 Trust. And so I learned much from him. He's a wonderful human being. And he's now in the office next door to me at Elam. So I'm still a good friend. And then after a couple of years of working with him, I got the phone call from John Glass, who was at the time the general superintendent, the boss of the Elam movement, asking me if I'd consider overseeing the National Youth Ministry. Yeah.
And before we get on to Limitless, yeah, what kind of stuff were you doing with Mark?
So it was evangelism. So we wrote evangelistic courses that we would deliver at churches for invitational events. So I had a course called Big Questions that young people or students or adults, it could work across the ages, actually would be able to invite their friends to. We were doing training in personal evangelism, so like boot camp type of things where we might do 5 weeks in a row training people how to share their faith, more so him than me, we would help churches form a strategy for evangelism.
Where did that passion for youth work for young people come from?
Well, I in the years of being in the band, obviously we were doing loads and loads of work with young people, not just in terms of performing at youth events. So there was lots of that. We were also on team on a number of occasions at Spring Harvest, and you know, leading youth small groups and doing all of those kinds of things, and then. Over the 2 years with Greenwood, I was speaking at a lot of youth events. So I can see how God was setting me up for what I was doing now, because what I got to do was I got to see youth ministry in loads of different contexts, different nations, different denominations, small, medium, large. And so it gave me a real understanding of the spectrum of youth ministry and what that could look like. But what I'd never done actually was been the youth leader at a local church, and that was one of my main questions when I was asked to do the Limitless role, although it was called Serious for God at the time, was, hang on, I'm not qualified for this. And so it was really important to me, cutting a long story short, that eventually when I did get into it, it was important, really important to me, that I was doing local church youth ministry at the same time. And so the church that my wife and I were worshipping in didn't have any youth ministry, and just had one young person there. So we grabbed a few people from the church and a few students from the Bible college. We got connected in with the local schools. I'd done loads and loads of schools work over the time with Dweeb and with Mark. I'd done loads of schools work. So I was kind of okay with that stuff, you know, assemblies and RE lessons and all of that business. And we got into the schools, we made some connections, and we launched out a new youth ministry for our church in Malvern. And for 2.5 years, I was leading that youth ministry. But at the same time, I was raising up a leader alongside me who I've now handed that over to. And so now I get to serve on her team. So I'm still doing local church youth ministry every week, but she's leading it now. And I'm on her team rather than she being on my team, which is great.
And what does a normal day look like in Limitless?
I mean, it's hard to say, really. It's so varied, which is something that I love about it. So it could be that I'm teaching at our Bible college program. It could be that we're planning our events, the gathering, Limitless Festival. It could be that I'm meeting with our leadership teams. It could be that I'm out and about traveling, speaking at local churches, speaking at youth events. Summer is obviously a very, very busy period. I tend to be round and about at the different summer festivals. So it could be that I'm writing talks. It could be that I'm fulfilling some of my wider Elim responsibilities with the other heads of ministry in the movement. Or it could be that I'm here at Premier speaking to you. It's really, really varied. So it's hard to say what an average day looks like, to be honest.
What is your least favourite thing to do in your job?
My least favourite thing is organising the events, because it's so hard. It's a real grind, and the pressure of it is massive. When you've got tens of thousands of pounds or more that are riding on that you're risking. And the risk is, are the people going to show up and pay for their tickets to pay for it? During the process, there are often times where I go, oh man, is it really worth it? But then you get there and you see young people encounter Jesus and be filled with the Holy Spirit, and you see young people become Christians, and you see young people gathered together and just lost in worshipping Jesus, and you go, it's worth it.
It was Serious for God.
Yes.
How did the name change come about?
When I first came into the role, one of my primary responsibilities, I felt, was to get a real clear understanding of who we were and what God was calling us to do. During that process, we came to some clarity over that. God began to speak to us about some things. And we came to 2015, which was Elim's centenary year as a movement. And God began to speak to us in that time about opening the door to the next 100 years as he wanted us to go on, with our faith high, with our expectancy high. It was beginning to become clear to us that that Serious for God as a name wasn't enabling us to communicate the thing that we wanted to communicate. And so began a process of talking with our teams, of praying, of seeking God. I remember we had a day where we had a brand consultancy expert come in, and we had all of the flip charts all on the wall and all of these exercises and all of this stuff, and nothing came out of that. And we were over with our team in Ireland. We began to pray together one evening, and one of the girls, Sarah, on the team in Ireland, she began to pray, and she said, God, I thank you that you're a limitless God. I thank you that the plans that you have for our young people is limitless. I thank you that the potential that our young people have in you is limitless. And she kept saying this word. And it was this amazing moment where the team just began to sit up on the edge of their chair, and people were opening their eyes and they were looking round at each other and were nodding. And it was just in this moment we knew that's what God was saying. We knew that is what God was proclaiming over us. And so Limitless, as a name, it wasn't about a rebrand. It was about announcing a new season. And so at the gathering in 2016, we launched that out. And it was a wonderful moment, yeah.
And you're a very natural preacher. What is it, do you think, that makes a good preacher?
It's interesting that you say, like, you're a very natural preacher. And yes, I do think I've got, like, a spiritual gift, which God's put in me. But I've also worked really, really hard at it. And I've watched preachers, I've listened to myself back, I've read books about preaching, I've learned things from those, I've tried to put them into practice, I've read talks, read books not just about preaching, but about communication, about TED Talks, and I'm constantly learning and working on that, fanning into flame, I guess, the gift of God that's within me. And so yes, I do have a gift for it, I guess, but it is important to say, I guess, to youth leaders or communicators who are listening, that sometimes you can see someone who's speaking at Soul Survivor or whatever, which I was very privileged to do this year, and think, oh wow, you know, a great speaker or whatever, but you've just got to start with what you've got, and you've got to put it into practice, and you've got to be hungry to learn and get people around you who are great preachers, and ask them to watch you, and then say, tell me hey, when I was speaking at Soul Survivor this summer, I've been preaching for a long time, I said to Ali Martin, Ali, I would love it if, because I was preaching in the morning and the evening at Week A in Stafford, and I said to her, I would love it if you could watch me with a critical eye and you could tell me where you think I could improve. Now, actually, as it turned out, I had diarrhea and vomiting on that day. So I just got in the car and went home as quickly as I could. So that's another story for another day. But at Soul Survivor Scotland, I was speaking at Soul Survivor Scotland, and Mark Ritchie, who's an excellent communicator, phenomenal communicator, he texted me after, he saw my talk, and he texted me after, he said, great job, Tim. I said, oh, mate, did you see it? Will you meet me for breakfast tomorrow and tell me where I could do it better? You know, so you've got to continually be seeking to learn and improve your craft. I know that's not the question that you asked me, but what makes a great communicator? It is true, somebody who's really hungry to learn and to grow and to reflect and to improve on their practice. Nobody is incredible on day one, and it's so easy, especially with our kind of social media saturated world, to compare your starting point to someone else's ending point. So put it into practice. Start with what you've got. Get people around you who will watch you, who will be able to give you some constructive criticism, tell you what was great, tell you where you can improve. And just do it as much as you can. But I think passion, I think clarity is really important. I think that preparation is really important. Make sure you know what you're going to say before you get there. I think it's a misnomer to say that if you've prepared your talk really well, then the Holy Spirit can't speak, because the Holy Spirit can equally speak to you in your preparation time as he can to you in the moment. So I think prepare really hard, study really hard. So clarity is really important. Passion is really important. And revelation is really important. It's easy for me to, you know, listen to my favourite speakers and regurgitate what they say and maybe put in some of my own stories. And inspiration is a good thing. But revelation is really where it comes from. So what makes a great communicator? Somebody who will spend time in the presence of God and will spend time in the Word, not just to prepare a message, but will spend time in the Word because they're a Christian, and in those times where they open up the Word and they spend time with Jesus, they hear from him, and some of those times then do inspire their preaching, but they didn't open the Bible just to prepare their talk, they opened their Bible just to hear from God. So revelation is really important as well. We could go on, but I'll leave it there.
What do you think the church needs to know about this generation?
I think that this generation is discontinuously different from the generations that have preceded it. And I think that that comes with some significant challenges, but I think also with some real opportunities. In terms of challenges, I would say I think that perhaps the greatest challenge is, we talked a little bit earlier on about the whole thing of the age of authenticity, but this whole thing of truth being relative to the individual, and in terms of the age of authenticity, what the individual feels. So you might have a different truth to me, you might have a different set of values to me, and those values, though different and perhaps even conflicting, are equally valid and true. Well, that doesn't make a great deal of sense, but the real issue is, because it's the age of authenticity, for me to say to you that what you believe isn't true and this is true, isn't just unpopular, it's immoral. And so because it's the age of authenticity, to ask somebody to... The call of discipleship is this: whoever wants to follow me must they do? They must deny themselves, take up their cross and follow me. That in the age of authenticity is immoral, because I'm telling you that to follow Jesus, you need to be willing to sacrifice on your authentic desires, age of authenticity, to deny yourself of what feels authentic to you. That does not scan well with this generation. But that is the cost of discipleship, and that is the call to follow Jesus. And so that, I think, is a challenge. One area where I'd say there's a real opportunity, though, is I think we've got a generation who are passionate about and able to make a difference. So I think it's a real entrepreneurial generation. They don't need intermediaries anymore, like teachers and libraries, because if they want to find out how to do something, to start something, to make something happen, then they just go on YouTube. You know, the Wi-Fi enabled generation, aren't they? So they can access information and they can put it into practice on their own. So we're seeing, I think, quite an entrepreneurial generation who are able to take hold of some things and make things happen, but also they're concerned about injustices. So let me give you an example of this. There's a girl in my youth group who wasn't a Christian, but she has become a Christian recently. She's called Sophie, and she's absolutely wonderful. This is before she became a Christian. She gives up her Saturdays to work at St. Richard's Hospice because she's really passionate about that. Last Christmas, she felt really sick of the whole consumerism that surrounds Christmas. So she made a decision that this coming Christmas, she's not going to ask for any presents. She's just going to ask people who would usually buy her a present to give her money, which she's going to donate to the St. Richard's Hospice. She's passionate about making a difference. She became a Christian recently. She was in the city near us where we live, which is Worcester. She got into a conversation with a homeless man, offered him the milkshake that she was carrying. And here's the able to make a difference bit coming up now. She got into the conversation with this guy, told her his story, why he was on the street, how he wasn't able to get a job. She took a photo on like a selfie of him and her on her phone, posted it to her Facebook page, saying, "This is his story. Can we help him get a job?" It went totally viral. It got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shares, 700 and something shares. This is just Sophie from Malvern. Hundreds and hundreds of likes, hundreds and hundreds of comments. It was picked up by the Malvern Gazette in our town and was published in the Malvern Gazette. And then somebody got in touch with this guy and gave him a painting decorating job. So she was passionate about the homelessness of this guy. In our conversation, she'd talked to him about her new faith. She'd given him some Bible verses that had been given to her. But she wasn't just passionate, "Oh, we should do something about that." She was able to use her social profile to take the initiative and to make the difference, surely that's an opportunity for the church.
How did becoming a dad kind of change your outlook on life?
Oh, wow. I mean, it changes everything. It changes everything in wonderful ways and in really, really challenging ways. I've learned a lot about the father heart of God. I know probably dads would say that often. But here's one thing I learned. I've always found it really easy to experience the pleasure of God in my activity. So in the things I do for him. So when I'm working hard or when I'm accomplishing something or when I'm out and I'm preaching, I found it easy to experience the pleasure of God over my life in those moments. But less so when I'm at home relaxing or going out for the run or, you know, doing those things I mentioned earlier. I've found that more difficult. And so I guess that in those moments I've therefore felt discontent, like I needed to do more for him and achieve more for him and accomplish more for him and take ground and all of that kind of stuff, I guess. And so in those stiller moments I've had that feeling of discontentment. But in becoming a dad I've learned something about that, because my children are really active and noisy and they're running around, they're all over the place, and they're doing all the time. And I do feel the pride of the father, if you like. I feel proud of them in those moments when they're riding their bikes or, you know, accomplishing something new. Tobias' first day at school recently, coming home with his work or a silver sticker because he got onto silver. You know, yeah, I do. So I do feel pride over their activity. But my favourite moment in becoming a dad wasn't any of those moments. My favourite moment is that rare moment that I could snatch just after their nap time, when they were still sleepy enough to be still, and I could just wake them up a little bit early, take them down onto the sofa, and they would just rest on my chest and not do anything. And that was the moment I loved the most as a dad. And so what I learned from being a dad was that yes, God is proud of me and my activity and the things I do for him and accomplish for him. But the moment he loves the most is just when I'm still in his presence. And so I've learned how to be content to be still with him.
You've been listening to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with Tim Alford and me, Emily Howarth, Deputy Editor of Premier Youth and Children's Work magazine.